Hi everyone, welcome to the Modern Web Podcast. I'm your host, Ray Shan. This episode is all about web accessibility. We're joined by Rob Dodson, developer advocate at Google, and Alice Boxhall, software engineer at Google. We talk about why accessibility matters to everyone, even beyond people with disabilities. We dive into the implementation details, such as navigation, semantics, and styling, based on Rob and Alice's web accessibility course. We explore the various guidelines and learning resources to help you improve your design and implementation. Enjoy the show. Okay, cool. Well, welcome to the show. Alice, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Totally. Hi, I'm Alice Boxhall. I'm a software engineer working on Chrome, specifically looking at accessibility, web standards, testing tools, advocacy, and so on.
Great. And Rob, nice to see you again. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Rob Dodson. I'm a developer advocate for the Chrome team. I do a lot of work on web components, and lately, a lot of work on accessibility. So basically covering a lot of our outreach and education efforts to make sure developers have kind of like the fundamentals that they need to build accessible experiences.
Great, great. Well, first, I just want to say thank you guys for your work. I know you guys have done a ton of work to get the tooling and the education materials ready to get developers more familiar with accessibility. And it is a very important topic. It is something that web engineers constantly think more and more about. So thank you for your work on this subject, and thank you for the courses you put on places like Udacity.
Of course. Yeah, thanks for having us on your show to sort of like help raise, the, like continuing to raise the profile of accessibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Our pleasure. Great. Why don't we start off by talking about why does accessibility matter? Alice, would you like to start?
Wow, that's a big topic. And sort of I wrote some notes for myself and now I'm like, oh, it's so big that I don't know where to start, actually.
Yeah.
It's really, nobody really wants to exclude people from their products. And especially sort of excluding a population which is already excluded from a lot of things is, nobody really wants to do that. So in terms of just, you know, we use this phrase a lot, it's just the right thing to do. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. There are also knock-on benefits. So it's really difficult, or if not impossible, to address accessibility without addressing usability. So we typically find that through the process of considering accessibility and considering usability for audiences that are maybe not the sort of young, perfect eyesight, perfect dexterity, people that a lot of software engineers might be, or designers and so on, that by considering these other populations that we end up with just a better design, a better product, easier to use for everyone. It's really beneficial if you can include people with disabilities from the get-go in your design research, user testing, all of the phases, because they will actually have insights on how to make things more usable, or like things that they have issues with that you may never actually think about otherwise, that are again going to feed into that process of making a more generally usable product.
Right. Rob, do you have another take on it?
Yeah. To echo a lot of what Alice said, I think one of the things that has always really stuck with me is the idea of thinking of, you know, giving folks access to information and the tools to do their work as a kind of a civil right, and the importance of making sure that, I guess one of the things that stands out for me is that there are a lot of folks who are, or if you look at the disability, or say the unemployment statistics within the community of folks with disabilities, it's higher than it should be. And that's because there are folks who could be, you know, out there working, doing a lot of stuff, but the tools and the applications that are being built to do work are just not being built accessibly. And so we're preventing those people from, you know, having employment and being able to do all the same stuff that everybody else does. And so I find that really frustrating and also very motivating, and a reason why I want to work on accessibility and improve it in the web, because I want to make sure that everyone's got same access and same advantages as everybody else.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think the key word that I always take away from any sort of accessibility talk is everyone. And that includes people with disabilities. It also includes people with learning difficulties. I just went through the entire WCGA 2.0 guideline for work. It was a surprisingly good read. And that was one of my most important takeaway as well, is it doesn't just talk about disabled people, colorblind people. It also talk about how to make your app just easier to understand and easier to use for really everyone. And that everyone even includes everyday regular users. So I thought that guideline was very meaningful.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And another sort of concept that we talk about a lot is the sense of situational or temporary impairments. So the thought that, you know, you mentioned cognitive impairments. And that's a good one. Like a lot of us are, you know, you get distracted, you get tired, you find like a really busy interface difficult to use, or maybe you're not distracted and tired to start off with, but then you get exhausted from just like trying to figure out this interface. So, you know, it's going to improve everyone's quality of life just to have things which may be accessible to someone with those types of impairments.
Well, yeah, I mean, along those same lines, like it's important to also recognize that everybody, like all of us, our bodies, our physical abilities and things like that are not static, they're not fixed. And as we age, our bodies are going to change. Our eyesight when we're 20 and our eyesight when we are older is not going to be the same necessarily. And so it's really, really important for everyone to consider that, like, it's going to definitely pay dividends when we are, you know, older and perhaps needing some of these things, that the accessibility work has been put in from the get-go. I think of it as, there's probably a lot of people who when they think about accessibility, they're just like, oh, well, that maybe that doesn't include me or something, but it really does encompass all of us. And as Alice was saying, it can vary based on the situation that you're in, the environment you're in, or just, you know, how, you know, the state that your body is in as we all age. So it really is an inclusive topic, and it's important to consider kind of the full range of human abilities when we're thinking about accessibility and why it's important.
If everyone would design their interface so that I can use it one-handed while standing on the train, that would be really wonderful. I'd really appreciate it.
Right. As web engineers, I think a lot of us, when we think about accessibility, we tend to associate it with regulation or some sort of like hard requirement. Many of us have gone through audits previously, and there are some well-known guidelines for us to use in order to meet accessibility standards. So WCAG is one of them. How do you guys think of that guideline, and are there any other guidelines that developers can follow?
So for me, I think WCAG or the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines are a very, very useful metric for folks, primarily because if you're new to accessibility, it's quite nice to have sort of a checklist. And the way the WCAG is sort of set up is through sort of like levels. So it starts at WCAG A, level A, which is, you could almost think of it as kind of like baseline accessibility, 2A, and then 3A. And basically with every level, you're kind of increasing, you're sort of increasing the amount of affordances that you're building into your application. For me, it's been very helpful to learn it, primarily because I think most developers have sort of a Swiss cheese understanding of how accessibility works. They know kind of random bits and pieces. They're like alt text. Yeah, I know about alt text on image tags, right? And then sometimes they might see ARIA. Yeah, they might see ARIA attributes or something, and they're like, I know those have to do with accessibility.
Right.
But what WCAG provides, which is really nice, is sort of a holistic overview of like, okay, here's how you can think about your entire application. And graduating levels of sort of advancedness or complexity in terms of what you're adding in. So I find it really useful for that.
Yeah, basically it does help you get like a broad overview of you know, this is what people who work in accessibility have put together over, I think, decades by now of, like, things that you need to consider to make an app accessible. So things that you may not necessarily think of or things that you sort of might forget, it just gives you that really useful checklist. And as Rob said, there's kind of the various levels which give you sort of like a triage level, you know, so if it's in A, like, really do that first. And then you're going to sort of prevent absolute showstoppers for a lot of people. And then you can progress from there.
Right, right. Another one I've come across is the state of California has some special requirements for accessibility in the education vertical. And I happen to deal with the education vertical for my day job. So they have a different set of standards, which overlap a lot with the WCAG guidelines. But it's certainly not the only guideline out there. But it was very, very helpful for me to learn and get started. And it is quite a large checklist, but it is quite comprehensive.
Yeah,
wow. I didn't actually know about that.
Yeah, I was gonna say in the United States, there's Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is it sort of mandates how federal agencies and folks receiving federal funding, so that could include schools and universities or NGOs. What they need to do in order to conform and be considered accessible. And that is 508, as I understand it, it just went through a refresh and is now based largely on WCAG level 2A with some like tweaks and additions added in there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and we're talking about the United States here, but I mean, different countries also have different guidelines and stuff like that. So it's important, you know, for whichever market the listener happens to be in, for them to be familiar with, you know, what and if, you know, the requirements are in the country that they live in.
Yes, definitely. And Alice, you're from Australia. Does Australia have any sort of special requirements for accessibility?
I haven't looked into that recently, I have to admit.
Just curious.
Last I looked, I think it's similar to the new 508 guidelines, so based on WCAG AA, but don't hold me to that because I can't remember for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, no problem. I just heard from some colleagues at work who are from the UK, who are also in the education sector, and they mentioned to me that in general, the US seemed to be one of the most strict countries regarding accessibility. So I think as far as that goes, we're doing an okay job here. Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the implementation details regarding web technology. One of the resources that I always refer people to is your course on Udacity on web accessibility. And I really like how you guys put in sort of like three major buckets, right? So you have focus, you have semantics, and then you have styling. That's like an easy way to think about like the major buckets that you need to think about. Why don't we start with focus and navigation? What do the engineers need to think about regarding that?
Yeah. So I worked mainly on the focus section, and the reason why I really like that section, or starting with focus in general, is because I think it's something that developers are already familiar with, just using their keyboard. Focus is fundamentally focus is just indicates which element on screen you're currently interacting with, which element on screen is currently receiving keyboard events, and it's driven, you know, largely by your keyboard. The reason why I think it's just a good starting point is everyone's already got a keyboard in front of them, and so it's very easy to test. And then it has sort of this knock-on effect of when you start to get a good focus strategy in your application, not only does it help, you know, people who primarily use the keyboard to navigate, folks who maybe don't want to use a mouse or can't because of like an injury or paralysis or whatever, but It also has this knock-on effect of helping like your power users and the people who just love knowing like every keyboard shortcut in an application, love being able to like zip around. Like most developers are like
right.
People that are like relearning Vim because they're like, I never have to touch the mouse. And it's like so it has this really cool effect. And I for one like love like keyboard shortcuts and inbox and things like that. So it's a really good entry point. And it gets you just thinking about the keyboard behavior in general for your application. And then that leads very naturally into kind of stepping it up to the next part, which is learning about screen readers. And then you start to get into the space of semantics, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should add sort of just from a technical perspective, kind of the primary way that you deal with focus in the browser is using the tab index attribute. So this is also nice because its focus is kind of limited in scope, which means as an entry point, it's easy to learn about, it's easy to wrap your head around, you feel like you can kind of master it. And basically the variations of tab index are, you can have a tab index of 0, which means, you know, I press the tab key and I can just automatically reach that thing. A tab index of -1 for something that is programmatically focusable, so I could like call focus on it, but I can't reach it using the tab key. That can be useful if you need to like temporarily disable something, or you have a part of the page where you want to like direct focus in response to a user action. And then you can have a tab index of >0, like a tab index of 5 or something. And what that means is that's going to kind of like jump that element ahead of everybody else in the tab order. And so while it is technically possible, it's actually considered to be a bit of an anti-pattern these days. One, because it's possible to create a really confusing keyboard experience doing that. But also, and this is maybe the larger reason, is screen reader users navigate your application in sort of DOM order for the most part. And so if you have elements that are like hopping ahead in sort of the focus order, unfortunately, the screen reader is not necessarily going to land on those orders in that sequence. It's just going to go in DOM order. And so you could end up with just an experience that's different for your users, and that's just kind of like wonky, and we'd like to avoid that. So sticking to tab index 0 and tab index -1 are kind of the rules of thumb. And then, you know, the first step is just you open your application. I'm sure folks listening work on an app every day or a site. Mm. You try to tab through the experience, and that can hurt your feelings sometimes because you're like, whoa, we got some work to do. you know, one of the largest things that you see is people disable focus styles, and because they don't like that little blue ring, and they don't provide an alternative. So it's okay to disable it so long as you provide an alternative. But a lot of folks don't even go that far. And so now you realize I'm trying to tab through my site. I can't even tell where focus is. Mm. And so that's a big issue that a lot of folks need to address.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I call that focus roulette.
That's a good way to put it.
Clear all or submit.
Right. Yeah. So I a fun fact, I started my career in finance. So I used to work in investment banking. And investment bankers, or at least at the lower level, we pride ourselves on being able to use Excel without a mouse.
Oh, yeah.
That is sort of like investment banking 101. You just like have to basically do every single thing in Excel with your keyboard.
It's faster, right?
It is significantly faster because you have 10 fingers, right? And I am definitely that guy. Like, I'm always trying to test if any website or web application enable keyboard navigation. And one of my biggest pet peeves is if you give me a modal and you don't let me to escape out of it, oh man, that just drives me crazy.
Well, yeah, the modal is sort of a tricky one because you want to that some folks consider the modal kind of the boss battle at the end of accessibility. Because what you want to do is for instance for a non-sighted user, you do want to trap the keyboard inside of the modal, because at that point when the modal is displaying, the application is oftentimes, you know, you kind of gray out the background. And so the application has kind of been this inert state, and we can maybe talk about that later. But so you want the user to only be interacting with the modal, right? And so that means that you kind of want to trap the keyboard focus there.
Right.
But of course you provide a mechanism like the escape key or something like that for someone to get out of it. But this is actually something that it's a pretty common problem where people don't trap focus in the modal. And so it could be saying something like, hey, do you want to save your work? Otherwise, I'm about to delete everything. But either focus wasn't directed into the modal to begin with, so someone doesn't even know it's displaying possibly, or they accidentally escape it and now they have no easy way to get back in. And so that's it's something that we actually talk about in the course, kind of in one of the later parts, but that's definitely one of the tricky things to keep in mind when you're dealing with focus.
That's a really good point, yeah. Cool. Let's talk a little bit about the semantic aspects of properly labeling your app. And I always really enjoy doing this for some reason, because I just think like if you have a input box and like it has no label on it, it's not clear to any user. So I'm always the guy who's like trying to go through everything and make sure everything's properly labeled.
Oh yeah, you mean like visible labels, like on-screen labels?
Well, I think both visible labels and things like the alt tag for images, right? Because, and that's something that applies to emails, right? If you don't have an alt tag for an image in email, sometimes your email client is text only, right? Going back to the Vim users, some people read their emails in the terminal. And yeah.
I remember those days. Yep.
So regarding semantics, would you guys like to talk about like how do we make sure that everything is semantically correct?
All right. So yeah, this is the part of the course I covered mostly. So I think Rob is like standing back, having gotten really enthusiastic about focus. He's like, Alice, you take this one. So semantics is obviously a really broad area. The reason that we need to add semantics and the reason that we sort of like we spend a lot of time thinking about screen reader and Braille users in general is that, you know, obviously a lot of our user interfaces are really visual in nature and they provide a lot of visual metaphors. Like I'm looking at my browser right now. Across the top of the browser is literally a list of tabs, and that list of tabs by design looks identical to a list of tabs in like a filing cabinet. And so I can see that and go, okay, I can tell that this is a thing where like some content is like behind or like tucked away in those tabs. And I know from practice that I can click on one of those tabs and it'll bring up some new content. So there's a visual metaphor that I can tell from just the geometrical design that's been used. For a screen reader user, you know, they have none of those sort of extra cues as to what's going on. And so you need to explicitly say what the thing is, like what the metaphor is that you're using. And so this is where we get into the ARIA roles. So we have the ARIA widget roles that allow us to say, okay, this is this kind of widget. It's a button. It's a tab. It's a radio button. And then you also need to group those, and this is where we get into the ARIA design patterns, which we can come back to, of saying, okay, a tab is not much good by itself. You actually need a list of tabs, and that needs to be associated with a tab panel. So this is kind of the crux of what we mean when we talk about semantics, is actually explaining to someone who doesn't get those visual cues what's going on in the UI. So that requires a lot of thought. And so this is why we sort of, in accessibility, we do end up putting a lot of emphasis, even though it's not obviously definitely not the be-all and end-all of accessibility, it does get a lot of sort of emphasis. Because it is sort of a whole different perspective to think about design from. So I mentioned the ARIA design patterns. So just to quickly come back to that, if people haven't checked those out, if they're interested in ARIA, that's a really good place to start. So if you just search for ARIA 1.1 design patterns, that actually brings up a full list of patterns, UI patterns that you can implement accessibly. They give you information on the structure, the DOM structure that you can use, the ARIA roles, but also the keyboard interactions that you should be like that users will expect to be able to use. So that gives you basically like a template that you can work off to just go, okay, I need to implement this pattern. I can work through each of these steps and then it should be accessible. So that's really, really helpful. Another aspect of semantics, or sort of, I guess, screen reader use more specifically, is landmarks. I feel like a lot of people, like, you can get your head around what the widget roles are doing and like, okay, yeah, that's a button. I know what a button is. Landmarks typically aren't visible or are sort of like much more subtly implied. So something like, you've got the header on a page, and it may not even have like a visual demarcation from the rest of the page, or like sometimes it has like a line or something. But being able to jump directly to a specific part of the page saves so much time for screen reader users. I was just chatting to someone, and she was talking about when she first learned to use a screen reader as a testing tool, and she was using JAWS and just pressing the down arrow to get through the content on the page, and she would just kind of get stuck and it would read some content out twice, or she would have to like go through every single sentence. And so I was talking to her about how useful landmarks and also headings are in terms of just providing that mechanism to get around the page a lot quicker. So that's something that I think gets a little underemphasized sometimes, because we do talk about widget semantics a lot, that it's actually really important to provide also that page structure to help people get around as well.
Right.
Yeah, to piggyback on that a little bit, like when I remember when HTML5 itself was first kind of rolling out and there were new tags like nav and like main and stuff. And I was like, well,
aside.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, like aside. And I was like, well, it's not like styled or anything. And I was like, why do I use this? I just use div for everything. And it really wasn't until getting into accessibility that I realized, oh, those elements have built-in native semantics, and that is incredibly valuable, because in something like a screen reader like VoiceOver, there's literally like a little key command that you can hit and you can see all those landmarks. So you can just jump to the sidebar or the aside, you know, you can jump to the main content, which is really useful, so you can bypass all the navigation. So yeah, I know a lot of developers, myself included formerly, like would just use div for everything, but definitely consider and give those elements a second look, because they're quite useful. They definitely improve the efficiency of your user experience.
Right. I think you brought up a really good point. So it's actually something I always use to convince myself or another engineer to implement things semantically, because you end up getting some behavior for free. An example would be a button, right? You can definitely use a div with JavaScript event listener to listen for clicks. But then that div is not tabbable by default. You also don't get some of the same touch behavior on mobile devices as if you would just simply change it to a button tag. And that's really all you have to do. And I believe if you just use a div with an ARIA row of button, you also get the same behaviors for free.
Exactly the opposite of that.
Is it?
Yeah, you don't get behaviors. Yeah. That's a big part of ARIA, actually.
That's by design. Yeah.
I see. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. But if you just use a button, then you do get some of the behaviors for free.
Exactly.
Right.
Oh, yeah. If you use button, you're all good. But it's really important. You sort of touched on something. I think it's really important to mention it. So ARIA can only add semantics. Mm-hmm. And so it can never add like keyboard behavior or anything, like, you know, it doesn't, button, for instance, has a disabled attribute. And when you put disabled on, it'll even like style it differently. It's no longer focusable because it removes it from the tab order.
Right.
Like ARIA is not going to be able to do that. So you're going to have to add those behaviors in yourself, which is another reason not to use a div button, because you're going to, it's subtle, but you don't realize how much is packed into something even as simple as button. And you have to end up recreating all of those things if you're trying to do that just with, you know, a div and a bunch of hand-rolled JavaScript. So ARIA will get you a little ways. It'll make things announced properly in the screen reader. But as for keyboard handling and all that, you're still going to have to do that yourself. one of the things I see really often is people make icons into like clickable things. So it's like an icon, they'll put a click handler on it. Mm-hmm. And a better thing to do is to take a button and sort of like knock out all the styles. So the button is just like transparent or whatever, and like pop the icon inside of that as a child of the button or something. I've gone through a site recently where I was like agonizing, and I was going through and I was like fixing all these little icon buttons everywhere. And I was like, guys, please just use buttons. Like, it was driving me so crazy.
I've actually recorded an entire episode of his show.
Yeah.
About just use buttons.
It's my plea for all web developers. Please just use the button element. It is your friend. The other thing that it gives you, which is really awesome, is if you add a click handler to the button element, and someone lands on it with a keyboard and they hit space or enter, it'll run your click handler. Whereas if you add a click handler to a div and someone lands on it and hits space or enter, it's not going to do anything. It's not going to magically. So now you're going to have to add key down handlers, and you're going to look for the key code that was pressed. But again, you get that click behavior for free with the button element, which is super neat, I think.
Right, right. I see that all the time too. Like a lot of times, if we just use the built-in browser APIs properly, the way that they are supposed to be used, we get a lot of free behavior without any additional JavaScript payload.
Totally.
Hopefully that's enough reason to convince everybody to start using buttons.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, the next section is about styling on your course. Styling, I think, it is definitely the fun part. So since we all love styling so much, we can start using a light gray background with light gray text and white borders, right?
not if you want folks to actually read it. Yeah. There's a lot that goes into the styling bucket, but the thing that you're touching on is the importance of contrast and making sure that all of your text has an acceptable contrast ratio, which is something that like WCAG actually explains. It gives you the actual ratios to use, which is really helpful. And Alice has also built some tools around this, which are pretty interesting, if you want to talk about those a bit.
Yeah. In the Accessibility Developer Tools extension, so most accessibility audits will audit the contrast ratio for you, but I wrote a tool to actually give you some color suggestions. And you know, as I've heard it, the point made quite aptly that you know designers probably aren't really going to go for that, but it does give you an idea of like this is how little you could tweak it by to make it an accessible contrast ratio. This is what it might look like, if you were to make it like a good contrast ratio. That was also really fun to write, so I have no regrets.
That's really nice. And we also have a lot of the tools for free in dev tools of browsers like the Chrome dev tools. I think this area sort of hits back to what Rob was saying earlier. As we age, our bodies do change, and I'm in my early 30s now, and I feel like my eyesight is not as good as my eyesight when I was 16.
Yeah, the other day I had to change my my color theme for my terminal. I was like, I finally couldn't do the low contrast theme anymore. I said it a few years ago because it kind of looked pretty, and then finally I was like, wait, I'm just getting headaches all the time. Oh no, it's happened.
Right, right, yeah. And I constantly do.
Oh, I was going to say there's a developer who does a lot of accessibility work named Hayden Pickering. And the first time I landed on his blog, I was like, man, the type size on this is really big. But I was just like blasting through the articles on there. And then I go to other websites now and I'm like, I wish the font was as big as Hayden's. Like, like I find his site so much more legible because it's more comfortable to read. And when you think about it, your laptop, my laptop oftentimes is like pretty far away from my face. You know, I don't usually work with like a big monitor or anything like that. So I routinely just like bump up the text size on websites anyway. But when designers think of that ahead of time, it's really nice. Like I think Medium is another good example of a site that has really, really generous text size and is therefore like really pleasant to read. Sorry, I just went off on a tangent because I wanted to give Hayden props because I really like People should go check out his site. I think it's called HaydenWorks.com. But the text size, the first time you see it, you're like, it's like really large. But now when I think about it, I'm like, it's a much more enjoyable experience for me to read something like that, where I feel like it's more comfortable, frankly.
It is always amazing to me how many people you see around who figured out the settings on their iPhones or any mobile device. But I especially see it on iPhones, where people have figured out the setting to zoom the entire UI and make their text size big on everything. Like, I was looking at my uncle's phone. He has the text, like, quite large. That's a really amazingly popular option. And actually, I think browser zoom is a great example of an accessibility feature which is just so very mainstream. It's really, really successful. It's really well implemented. The developers, this is kind of the holy grail. We love to tell developers to do things, but it's even better when developers don't have to do anything, and developers don't have to do anything to get the benefit of browser zoom. Not quite true, actually. I tell a lie. You do need to make sure that your layout can handle the handle being zoomed. So it's always a good idea.
I was just about to say, like, responsive design has this, like, great knock-on effect, because what tends to happen is, as you're zooming the page, it just eventually reflows into your mobile layout if you're on the desktop. But yeah, if you were designing mobile first from the beginning, then that's, like, A-okay. Like, everyone's like, sweet, you know, like, it handled it quite well. So that's one of those areas, any of those areas where you get the sort of nice overlap. And again, it's sort of, I know people like to, in their head, lump accessibility just over on the side as, like, this special thing that they got to work on. But really, it's part of usability and user experience. And so that's one of those areas that I think really, as Alice was saying, like, highlights that really well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this comes back to what I was kind of saying about, we focus a lot on screen readers and Braille displays because it's such a different way of using a website. But everything in accessibility, sort of everything else, you know, the contrast, the text size, resizability, all of those things really, really contribute to just a much more usable experience. And I love the example of Medium. Medium came up in a talk I saw on accessibility for people with cognitive impairments, because it's so minimal that people with cognitive impairments really, really enjoy it. And cognitive impairments is a very, very broad class, but there were some specific types of impairments where, you know, people who may be, like, really quite impaired really love reading long-form text because there's absolutely no distractions. And sometimes it doesn't even matter what it was. There was this anecdote of someone really, you know, this little boy who's really quite impaired reading recipe sites because the structure is so predictable and so soothing. And so he just started cooking all this pasta because he was reading all these pasta recipes. And so, you know, we all love a site that is as minimal as possible and, again, doesn't contribute to that cognitive load and that, you know, decision fatigue that we all get by the end of the day. And so that's a perfect example of the point that Rob was making and that we made earlier about designing for people with disabilities right from the start really does make a much more accessible experience.
Right.
Much more usable and pleasant experience for everyone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is, it's probably worth, like, throwing into the show notes, but I think the folks at Microsoft have highlighted this really well recently with their work on inclusive design. And this gets back to some of the stuff Alice had mentioned earlier about being sort of situationally or temporarily impaired. This notion that, you know, when really what we should be doing is designing for, especially because we have mobile devices now and we take our mobile devices with us and they're constantly in different contexts. So sometimes you're using your phone in a loud environment, sometimes you're using phone in a really bright environment, like you're outdoors or something like that. And so when you start designing from that perspective, you get sort of the knock-on benefit of it helps everybody. It helps someone who maybe like a low vision user who has a tougher time discerning contrast or reading the screen. If you're designing from the perspective of someone's going to take their phone outside and it's going to be really sunny, and so we're going to need to have good contrast anyway, then you're including those folks as well. You get this nice umbrella effect. So there's a lot of areas I feel like now where we're starting to see really, really good beneficial overlap with design and accessibility just being like a natural part of that.
Absolutely. Something else I just came across lately was in Safari 10 and beyond, WebKit stopped respecting the user scalable node tag. And I always tell people, stop putting that there because I want to zoom in to see the text and the images on my mobile devices. I think it's interesting that they made that move in favor of more accessible and usable applications and websites.
Yeah, like originally, I think the reason why people would do the user scalable no is there were kind of two reasons. Like one, people thought maybe it made their experience feel more app-like. And the other, which actually was, in my mind, possibly a more compelling reason for developers to do it, was that I believe Safari used to remove the 300 millisecond click delay on mobile if you had user scalable no.
Oh, right. Right.
And so I think a lot of people started using it for that reason. Now, if you just have a properly set viewport, so you say viewport width equals device width or whatever, that will also be used as a signal to Safari to remove the click delay. So, and bonus points, that's, again, going back to responsive design, that's like the first part of building a responsive website is having that correct viewport set. So you can get rid of user scalable no, you can use the correct viewport, your site will zoom nicely, and you're setting yourself up for responsive design. So it's like a total win.
Right. Cool. Well, we covered the major parts and the major buckets that engineers have to think about regarding accessibility. Now let's talk a little bit about everyone's favorite subject, testing. What are some of the good ways to debug or test for accessibility?
Alice, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the tools that you're working on? Because there's definitely some cool stuff in the works. I don't know. Are you not allowed to talk about them yet?
I can totally talk about them. So we're talking about debugging specifically. So there are a bunch of testing libraries around. Axcore by DQ and Tenon, a couple of the sort of newer ones that are really popular, really high quality. In terms of debugging, I don't think there's as much out there, so that's what I'm trying to focus on. So what I'm working on is a sidebar pane in Chrome Developer Tools. It's an experiment, so if you turn on DevTools Experiments, it's then there as the accessibility inspection experiment. Mm-hmm. What that'll give you is you'll be able to look at part of the accessibility tree. So we haven't touched on that, so let me quickly explain what that is. We talked about semantics. So the accessibility tree the accessibility tree is like the platonic ideal of what various platforms expose to assistive technology. So iAccessible 2 or UI automation on Windows, I forget what they are on other platforms. There's one for Mac and iOS. There's another one for Android. All sort of share this common notion of having a tree of nodes that you can look at, a tree of accessibility objects that tend to correspond, but not quite one-to-one to the DOM tree. So a good example being something like a div will often be completely pruned out of that accessibility tree because it just doesn't provide any useful information. Unless it's got like a label or something on it, a div is often noise because it's often just used for sort of visual layout. So the accessibility tree tends to be flatter, and then it's just the semantic information of the page. All the landmarks, all the widget roles, all of the headings, anything that might be useful to assistive technology will go in there. So you can actually interact with what that looks like from this pane, which I'm really excited about. It's quite difficult to sort of get that information. Otherwise, you've got to use platform tools, or on Windows, there's only third-party tools. Sometimes you have to build them from source. Like it's certainly not an easy thing to do. Another one is that it gives you, there's a little ARIA pane that shows you the ARIA attributes that have been applied for an element, and then there's a computed accessibility properties pane for the node that you're inspecting. So that'll give you all of the semantic information, the roles, the states, including if they've come from a native element. So if you look at a, if you inspect a button, it'll tell you it has a role of button, even though you've never set the ARIA role on it. Plus two things that I'm really excited about. One is that it gives you a rundown of how the label has been computed. So in HTML, we have a whole algorithm for computing the accessible name of an element, which takes various sources like the ARIA labels. ARIA labeled by the contents of the element, which like doesn't always get to be used. Any like other HTML labels, there's like a whole series of sources that it can come from, and this tool lays out all of those sources, shows you which ones have been used and what overrides what, so you can debug the name of your element. And the other thing that it gives you is if the element has not been included in the accessibility tree, it tries to kind of explain why that's happened. So the vast majority of the time, it's like, well, this is just not an interesting element. It doesn't tell the screen data anything. But there's also things like, okay, it's in an array hidden area, or it's on a page with a modal dialogue that's showing, so you won't be able to access this element. So yeah, so that's a rundown of what that tool is going to be doing. Working hard on that, but I'm not doing podcasts.
Alice also mentioned a few of the other libraries out there. In particular, axe is really great. So AXE, like a chopping axe, is really great. So there's a Chrome extension for axe. There's a recently released command line tool, axe CLI, which you can just like in your terminal, you could be like axe and then put in like a website like google.com or something, and it'll just try and audit it from there, which is really nice. There's also Wave, like a wave that you would surf. That's a good Chrome extension, very similar to what axe is doing. Also Totally, TOTA11Y. I realize we didn't define the A11Y like shorthand on this podcast, so we should do that. So for anyone who doesn't know, if you ever see A11 or A11Y, that's just the word accessibility, and it's letter A, 11 letters in between, and a letter Y, because it's really hard to spell it right. But Totally, that's another really good one by the folks at Khan Academy. And recently, we started working on a tool called Lighthouse for measuring progressive web apps. And under the hood, we have accessibility tests in Lighthouse now, and those are also powered by Axe Core. I feel like there's a lot of cool tools out there for testing accessibility. The one thing to really note, though, is that you can only really test a subset of what you really need to be doing using automated tools. There's some stuff that you're just never going to be able to do an automated test for. So for example, if you have video content, is it providing like a text transcript or something like that? Because really, like, I'm not even sure how you would do an automated test for that, right? So these tools will get you...
Well, you can look for the track element, but people don't always use those.
Oh, good point, yeah. There's stuff out there that maybe that's not the best example then, but there's stuff out there which is hard.
My favorite example is what I call the accessibility bootstrap problem. So say you've got a custom element, you need to put some roles on that. You need to put like all of the semantics on that because custom element, it doesn't have the built-in semantics. How do you know? How do you find where those semantics are meant to go to know that they're missing unless they're provided?
Right. Yeah, if someone built a div button but never gave it a role or a class of button, then you're just like, oh no, it's a div. Like, I don't know what that thing is, right? So the tools can get you a little ways. They're really helpful, for instance, if you're like a widget author, you're building a style library and you want to watch out for regressions and things like that. But it's also really important to make sure you're still doing manual testing, you're going through stuff. And
I was going to say, the tools will also help make sure you're not wasting your manual testers' time on something that could have been caught by an automated tool.
Sure. I think the one piece of advice I would give any developer listening is familiarize yourself with like one screen reader, like learn the basics of tabbing around a page and what the expectation is there. And then familiarize yourself with one screen reader. And if you're on a Mac, there's already a screen reader installed. You may occasionally accidentally turn it on by hitting Command F5 and freak out. But that's a good thing. Stay with that moment. If you go into the settings, you go into the like accessibility settings on Mac OS, there's a guide to VoiceOver. It's like 20 slides. It's super easy. Like it literally takes like 10, 15 minutes, and it'll teach you all the basics that you need to learn for VoiceOver. And if you're on a PC, there's NVDA, which is an open source donation funded screen reader that you can pick up and start using.
Written by two Australians. Thank you very much.
Made by Australians, so it's quality stuff. Although everything is upside down, so that's weird. But if you just hold your laptop upside down, it works.
Luckily, it's audio only, so you can't tell that it's upside down.
I guess that's a good point. but anyway, like there's free options out there. You can pick one or the other. There's other great screen readers, by the way. I'm not trying to like exclude things like Jaws or anything like that. These are just like two that come to mind, and they're both like free, which for a lot of developers, it's a really big deal. But you can pick them up, and then you can do some of this manual testing yourself. And it's really important. You just start to understand your page better fundamentally. You're like, I understand the semantics of my page, and that's kind of cool. It's very empowering. So yeah.
Cool. A lot of different options out there. I definitely need to explore them myself. Great. Well, if developers out there would like to learn more about accessibility, besides your awesome course on Udacity, the web accessibility course, what other resources are out there for us?
So I'm going to plug more of our own stuff. So if you go to,
sure,
if you go to developers.google.com, so developers.google.com/web/fundamentals, there's a /accessibility. There's a whole accessibility section there, which covers a lot of the material from our course. Our course is like largely a video course, so this covers a lot of it in text format. But we're also adding new content to that site. So that's going to be, as far as like Chrome developer relations is concerned, that's going to be like the home for all of our accessibility guidance. And then also I have a show that I do on YouTube called Alicast, A11Y Casts. That comes out fortnightly every 2 weeks. And that's kind of more
so
fun.
British.
Yeah, I know. Well, if you say bi-weekly, people are like, is that what? So fortnightly. But yeah, like, and that's just like kind of fun and a little bit more silly and just covering like, it's like little bite-sized stuff. So like, you know, 6-minute videos about like one particular topic that I want to talk about that day. So that's it for me. Alice, what do you got?
Yeah, WebAIM we refer to a lot in our course. Really solid articles on accessibility, a lot of like taking you from the basics through to more advanced. One article on there that I find myself referring to quite a bit is like as simple, as straightforward as how to write good alt text, how to write a good like text alternative description for an image. And there's sort of like, there's some subtleties to it. Like, you know, trying to put the most important information up front, trying to keep it to a certain length, things like that. So that's the kind of content that they have on there, like really, really specific, really useful things, and really well written by a lot of experts. Another place that I go often is the Web Accessibility Slack. We'll put a link in the notes on how to get access to that. But yeah, that has a lot of accessibility experts hanging out in there. A lot of the community will hang out in there, and there's often discussions. Sort of people come in and say, "Oh, hey, I'm having this specific issue with Chrome and VoiceOver. Has anyone seen that?" Or people come in and be like, "Oh, what's the best practice for this?" And so it's really wonderful to sort of see that conversation going on and see what kinds of problems people are running into. I mean, for me as a browser developer, I love sort of hearing about people running into browser bugs, and then I can be like, aha, I can file a bug on that. But also just the being getting in touch with developers, and as a developer, getting like being able to have access to those experts. People are really friendly. There's often discussion going on in there.
Oh, I wanted to add one more really quick, since you mentioned WebAIM. WebAIM also has a mailing list, which is really good to subscribe to. And one of the reasons why I find it really interesting is there's folks on the list who are assistive technology users. And I think, you know, when you're working on accessibility, or if you're new to it, sometimes you run into a situation where you're like, I'm not quite sure what the expected good experience is for this widget. And so that's a good resource, because you can just kind of ask the community. You can ask experts, you can ask the people who actually use the assistive technology, and you can be like, all right, I'm building this thing. How would you prefer this work? And you can actually get direct answers. So I find that to be a really, really cool resource. And I like lurking on that mailing list and just sort of like seeing what people say. And sometimes it really, you know, can change your perspective on the way that you think something is supposed to work. And then the way that people are like, you know what, this is actually how I prefer to use it. So that's kind of cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah. That actually reminds me, should probably go without saying, but like, as you said right at the start, reading through WCAG is actually, as you said, like quite an interesting read, especially WCAG 2, they laid it out really nicely. They broke it down so that you can get like a high level overview, and then you can drill into each requirement and get an explanation of why it's important, get an explanation of the techniques that you can use to kind of implement a solution to the problem that it raises. And maybe this is probably going to be less popular, but I'm actually a fan of the ARIA spec and the ARIA design patterns. So yeah, probably not a lot of people get as much enjoyment out of reading the ARIA spec as I do. That's like kind of a quirk, but it is quite interesting to sort of understand how all of that hangs together. But also the ARIA design patterns are a really useful resource for, again, like getting those design patterns implemented.
Yeah, if you're building widgets and components, I would say the ARIA design pattern stock is the most useful resource, because it literally is like step-by-step instruction for how a thing should work. Like, it's like, here's what happens when someone hits the up key. Here's what happens when they hit escape. Here's the rules to apply. And it's like really, really terse, which I love. It's just like, do this, boom, 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 checklist items. And then you're like, sweet. So yeah, absolutely. Go check that out.
Right. And since you mentioned widgets, one thing that's really helped me as an engineer is to look at reference implementations. So I would refer to Bootstrap. So I think Bootstrap has done a really great job on making their work accessible. And the other one that I refer to would be the Angular Material Design UI library. I think they've also done a really great job. And some websites also have done a fantastic job. I would look at apple.com. Apple has always been at the forefront of accessibility. And GitHub. GitHub, its UI is quite complex, but surprisingly accessible. And they seem to enjoy leaving the default blue border around all the elements. So I'll try to tab around, and it's really easy to see. It might not be the most aesthetically pleasing blue border, but it is very, very easy and obvious to see where your tab focus is.
Yeah, and if you check out the ARIA authoring practices guide, they have example implementations for all of the patterns, and you can go look at the source. So that is really helpful, because I know on a number of occasions I've just sort of like taken the source and like migrated it and like tuned it up and, you know, made it fit my particular needs. So yeah, that's a good point. Having those resources out there that you can actually like go look at the code, and everything is quite handy.
And just one more, a little accessibility inspiration from Marcy Sutton's a11ywins.tumblr.com, her accessibility wins website. She's been a little quiet on it lately. I think she's gotten busier with work and has less time to sort of curate it, but it's just a collection of people send in things that are really nicely done for accessibility. And it may not be that the entire website is completely accessible, but there'll be sort of one thing on it that really nicely illustrates some kind of good accessibility practice. So if you just sort of want to feel good about accessibility and see some like nice examples of well-implemented accessibility, that's a really good spot for it.
Cool. We'll definitely have that in the show notes. Alice, how will people find you on the web in order to ask you more questions on accessibility?
Yeah, the accessibility Slack. I'm on there as Alice. I'm also Alice on GitHub. And on Twitter, I am Sundress. S-U-N-D-R-E-S-S, like the garment.
Cool.
Those are the best places to find me.
Great, great. And Rob, how will people find you on the web?
I'm also on the accessibility Slack. I am Rob Dodson, so D-O-D-S-O-N, all one word, on GitHub. And on the Twitters, I'm @Rob_Dodson. I use the underscore. I'm real hip, like Paul _Irish. Me and Paul. You can find me on the Twitters, ping me, ask me questions, or just say hi. And definitely go check out our course.
Cool. Great, great. Well, thanks everyone for joining us.
Absolutely a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
If you really enjoyed this episode, please rate us on iTunes. It really helps. You can find more Modern Web podcasts and meetups on Twitter @modernweb_ and on the web @modern-web.org. We'll see you soon in the next episode. Yeah! Queries too, so come on, let's go, 'cause we got a show for you.